treasure that we have above the rest. We all need love. Oh, we all need love. Yeah.
Demis and Pliers. Me love you. Temple Sounds of Culture, for joining us. Welcome, everybody. I'm your host, Dr. Kenya Osi Radoli. You can count on me. Always there. Broadcasting from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to the rest of the United States of America and also across the world. It was another tough week. A brother of ours from Lodge 314, the Bubbin Brothers, Dave Curl, got to lay his mom to rest. Dave Curl and his family, we went down to Wheeling, West Virginia. What a fantastic service. It was somber, but full of friends and family that were down there. I got to meet Dave's family as well. May mom rest in peace. May mom rest in power. Up next is a group called the Freedom Band. It's actually a reggae band from Pittsburgh. The band is not together. However, they're very good friends of the Temple Sounds of Culture. The song coming up is called Hands Up. Keep it locked right here on Temple Sounds of Culture. Let's keep jamming.
Problems and we'll make it all right. Yes, grab your partner, rush your body to the dance floor. Show the people around you them they want you came for. Intoxication not required for sure. Dalang, 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 it's just your blessings galore.
Freedom, we're on your stereo. Lift up your hands and let your body flow. Sweet up the dance and let your troubles go. Whining, 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 whining down.
Up and down.
Rewind and make we come again. Twice as nice now, twirl and grab your friend. Keep it going so the party never ends. Whining, 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 whining down.
You know you're cooler than a cup of ice. Sweet as cherry pie, you know I want to have a slice. Sexy as you wanna be, you make me feel nice. Come down again, you know we'll bring it to you twice. Mission to please all the people in the dance. Free up the universe, oh, the reggae chant, chant, chant.
I only want you up. I really need you, baby. Come to me, show me your loving. Listen, I don't want no next girl. I only want you. Nobody else will do. I don't want no next girl. My love is so true. Girl, I feel brand new when I'm with you. I can feel it. Got that lovey-dovey feeling. I can see it in your eyes. My affection, you are needing. The smile of an angel with a heart that lights the room. Let me take you by the hand. Now is not too soon. I don't want no next girl. I only want you. Nobody else will do. I don't want no next girl. My love is so true. Girl, I feel brand new when I'm with you. 6 in the morning, I'm still tangled up in you. kissing and hugging, holding and squeezing. I don't know what to do, 'cause I don't wanna lose this good thing. When the feeling is so right, I want you morning, noon, and night. I don't want no next girl, I only want you. Nobody else.
The Freedom Band from Pittsburgh.
I don't want no next girl.
No next girl.
My love is so true. Girl, I feel brand
new. When a group is great, we play back to back. Hello, Pittsburgh. Hello, Pennsylvania. What's happening? What's shaking?
My love is so true.
It's a Saturday night, and we're doing the Steel City Reggae set. And soon we shall be saying AI City. AI started here in Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University.
Just wanna play the game.
And we're doing our level best to be the leaders of AI and machine learning.
Giving back the same. You got the.
So one of these days we shall make the switch from Steel City to AI City, AI machine learning city. What the heck, I'm gonna do it here on this show.
Don't want no next girl. I only want you. Nobody else would.
Up next, the group is an artist called Romain Virgo.
Don't want no next girl.
I get so hyped up because the music is really blaring in my headphones, and I get so pumped up with the energy of the Timber Sounds of Culture show.
Yes, I do. Morning and noon and the evening. Yeah, yeah. All about you, baby. Yeah. I've been needing your affection. I know you need, know you need, know you need.
Romain Virgo. Take it or leave it.
Just wanna keep it real with you. I don't love the way you make me feel. Let's Superman, this can't be real. When I'm your Superman with a steel, fight for you on a battlefield. I just love it when you talk to me, baby. I just wanna make you feel like a queen, yeah. We know you are, we know my star. Girl, I love who you are. I have the love to give. When we argue and fight in the end, I
for fun, and maybe you've already won.
Bobby Alou, keep it tropical. Just noticed we're really playing that laid-back reggae set. You're tuned into the Tempo Sounds, the culture, and I wanted to make sure that I introduce people to what the Caribana is all about. If you ever wanted to experience a vibrant explosion of music, color, and the Caribbean pride right here in North America, then let me introduce you to the Toronto Caribana in Canada. Now, the Caribana is Canada's largest Caribbean carnival and one of the biggest in the world. Held every summer in Toronto, it's a spectacular celebration of Caribbean culture with roots in Trinidad and Tobago's carnival. Carnival kinda tings. From the breathtaking costumes and the soca-fueled parades, to steel pan rhythms, dancehall vibes, and Afro-Caribbean food, there's a bit of some Afro beat that's fused in, or it's fusioned. It's fusioned into the mix there. This is more than a festival. It truly is a movement, a commitment, a brotherhood, a sisterhood, a vibe of rhythm of resilience and joy. Now, whether you're Caribbean, whether you're Caribbean born, meaning whether you're Jamaican, Trinidad and Tobagoan, whether you're from St. Kitts, the Bahamas, listen, the Caribbean goes way, 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 way deep. This is where cultures really connect. Freedom is expressed and the streets of Toronto come alive in a burst of unity and celebration. So get ready, because the road is calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's about a 3-hour drive to the New York border. To my Canadian friends, you know I got to bring you guys some bourbon. So I don't want to hear that you're not partaking to some of Kentucky's finest. Hey, that's my gift from Pittsburgh to you all. Dave, Charlie, hope everyone in Canada is ready to get some of that Tembo Sounds of Culture into the mix, yeah? Some old school reggae, Ja Shaka and Aswad. Great song called the Aswad Special. Mayut, Pittsburgh, Wagwan. Nesta Marley, Kinky Reggae.
Oh, please don't you rock my boat. Cause I don't want my boat to be rocking. Oh no. Oh please don't you rock my boat. No, no. Cause I don't want my boat to be rocking.
Nesta Marley, you're listening to Temple Sounds, The Culture. And did you know that Bob Marley's final concert ever was right here in Pittsburgh?
Can't you see?
It took place on September 23rd, 1980 at the Stanley Theatre. Now, during this time, Bob Marley was battling illness, but full of fire. Bob Marley delivered a powerful, emotional performance, closing the show with Get Up, Stand Up. It was a moment of musical history and spiritual strength that lives on in the hearts of the fans worldwide. Pittsburgh witnessed the legends, Lust Live Raw. The Lion of Judah, Robert Nesta Marley, continue resting in power. And it's that time where we play the commercials and the public service announcements before we go to the next set. Temple Sounds of Culture, keep it locked. WRCT 88.3 FM, Pittsburgh, PA.
bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
You're fierce. You take care of business and don't hold back. Taking care of your health shouldn't be any different. You know when something's off. Don't ignore symptoms like fatigue, joint pain, and rashes. Listen to your body. It could be lupus. We're here to help you take control. Learn how at BeFierceTakeControl.org. Brought to you by the Lupus Foundation of America and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
RCT 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, before we get into the mix of things today, just wanted to let you guys know that everything that you're going to hear today is strictly the opinions of myself and my guests today, and don't necessarily represent the views of WRCT. We're back. We're actually doing new episodes. I promise this is a thing. We're making it happen. And we have a guest today. We're actually talking about something interesting, or a couple interesting things today. We have a longtime friend of mine, hailing from Texas. We have Gavin here with us today. Welcome to The Angry Young Man.
Hello.
Yeah, so, I mean, I had a couple things that would be interesting for us to talk about. I know there was something you wanted to talk about, but I've been reading what some may call the book of the year so far. I'm reading Abundance by Ezra Klein.
I have a copy of that.
You have a copy of that? I just now got a copy because they had, ironically, Abundance was not abundant for a period of time. I just got a copy of it. It's interesting because, you know, if for those of you who have listened to the show before, you'll know that I have a little bit of a fixation with housing. But it's interesting to see, you know, this argument for abundance liberalism and talking about using state capacity to kind of pursue growth and look at these things. I've only gotten about 30 pages into it so far. There's some things that I agree with. There's some things I disagree with. But I guess we'll start off this segment by kind of getting at that. I mean, Gavin, would you consider yourself an abundance liberal?
I'm not. I don't know. I guess I agree with the idea. I don't know.
I mean,
how would you define abundance liberal? And we'll go from there.
Well, I find it kind of the defining factor that separates it, the abundance liberal from, say, you know, the free market absolutist or fundamentalist, is the idea that there's a necessity to use state capacity to go after both supply and demand. I mean, they look at it as, and they open in the book by saying that, you know, for so long, because the fundamental kind of crux of economics is supply and demand, how it's been divided in half, and each side of the political spectrum has kind of made one of those their baby, in the sense that the right has been entirely supply focused and the left has been entirely demand focused. And, you know, the lack of understanding that both have their own importance, because they are supply and demand, not just supply or just demand. They kind of advocate for the pushing of both to go about things. I mean, I have my fair share of disagreements kind of going out the gate with some of the claims, specifically as they relate to using state capacity to push for a lot of these things or to subsidize demand. Or look for some of those things. They may be addressed later in the book. I haven't gotten just far into it just yet. But I mean, I'm curious. To what degree do you subscribe to those sorts of claims? And if so, what's your critique of say the market fundamentalist approach that I'm sure you know you're aware that I hold on this matter.
Yeah, I'd say. In all things, in housing, which is our first topic, in food, in water, there we have, I guess, the title of the book, we already have a superabundance of all of these things. We have enough where if we had the perfect allocation of resources, a perfect system, nobody would ever starve. Because we have more food than anyone could eat. We have more housing. We have more homes than homeless people. All of these things. So we're at a point now where it's not really a matter of how do we grow food? How do we have more houses? How do we have enough for everyone to survive? Which is what most of human history was about. And we now are at a point of, okay, how do we think about our systems to have them structured in such a way that everyone... has enough. And I think that's kind of where we should be going forward as a society at this point. So especially in terms of housing, I don't think we should accept homeless people as a concept at all. And if that means somebody has like a homeless shelter, that's like a little studio apartment, then that's what that is. I think you should be given the bare minimum. And I think beyond that, if you want to work for something harder, absolutely. Like even, and this is where I'm going to lose people, but like even if you're like a drug addict and you want to be in your home all day doing drugs, I don't think you should have a particularly good quality of life. I don't think, because you're not contributing to society at all. But I don't think it's very ethical to say somebody should die. In that circumstance, just should be on the street and have no societal support. And it's not even like an ethical thing. Like homeless people are a drain on society as they exist. If they overdose, that's a drain on our medical system. If they live in like a northern climate, Pittsburgh, whatever, and it's the winter and they have pneumonia or frostbite or whatever. I don't know. I'm from Texas, so I don't know what happens when you get cold. It's a mystery. That's also a drain on the medical system. If they do a crime because they're so desperate and hungry and they have to go to prison, that's a drain on our prison system. So I think overall, you can even make an argument that just housing these people would be a cost-saving measure for society, for taxpayers overall. So that's sort of my position.
So, I mean, one of the kind of key things I want to zone in on, no pun intended, is... you know, you mentioned, you know, the crisis of homelessness, and something that they bring up very quickly in the section on at the outset is this idea of, you know, why do we have homelessness? Why does this happen? And mm-hmm. you know, they kind of zone in on the fact that more often than not, it's a cost issue, you know, in terms of how much the homes cost. And you know, in a lot of ways, I don't necessarily agree that we have enough housing or an abundance of housing. That, you know, at least in our metropolitan areas, there's not an abundance in the sense that we're able to address the massive demand of these areas. You look at states like California and New York that have been historically and notoriously bad at trying to address these issues with their zoning policies. I mean, you can drag in redlining if you really wanted to, but you know, it kind of falls down on this issue of there's this strand of liberal policy which has attempted to restrict supply, and as a result, has caused the crisis of homelessness, because all of these other things that we look at as a result, where you have the drug epidemic as a result, or turning to violence, these are symptoms of the problem, not necessarily the problem in of themselves. So, I mean, at least coming from my part of things, you know, you can address the cost issue at no cost by pulling back on a lot of these regulations that states like California and New York have been putting so much effort into holding up, and or at least have felt the pressure from the NIMBYs in their respective communities to uphold these regulations, which, quite frankly, it doesn't really cost anything materially outside of maybe the administrative cost of just kind of keeping the lights on while you're debating it. You know, for you to roll back these things, and you already experience so much change from there that, you know, it's an ambiguous amount of change. You know, how much are you going to make a dent in the homeless population? How much are housing prices going to fall down? But you could look at some pretty good case examples. You know, in your home state of Texas, I believe it was Austin that just recently saw rents tumble about 20% because the housing stock went up. You know, and that's it ultimately falls down to, you know, can you allow the market to address demand? I mean, if you're getting rid of these artificial caps, that should do enough in of itself. And then you kind of ask the question, well, is it necessary for us to start subsidizing demand again on your front of things? It would appear that your position to an extent requires some amount of subsidizing demand, or you know, doing some sort of subsidy to allow for access to housing. So I'm curious if that, you know, how that would play out, and to what degree the government or state capacity to act would be necessary if you were able to pull back on just the caps on supply.
Yeah, so just to re-clarify my position, like, obviously right now, like, there's not, there is a lot of cities where the housing situation is so far not great, not conducive to, like, universal housing. You know, how do I put this? Like you were saying, like, rents are exorbitantly high in Los Angeles and New York. But I think my position is this is not like a human economic. Like, we have the labor capacity, we have the technology to build enough homes for everyone to live, just simply, just as simple as that. So then the question becomes, why don't we have that? I think you adequately addressed some of these issues. A lot of it, well, all of it is just policy issues, basically. Some of it might be like cultural or whatever, but I feel like the vast majority is policy. These are policy decisions that are very deliberately put in place. A lot of it is like the YIMBY NIMBY debate. We know. I was going to pick up Austin myself because it's an example I'm well aware of. It's right in my neighborhood, so to speak. You know, Austin has grown so, so much. You can look at a skyline picture of, like, Austin in 2015 versus Austin today, and it's like, it looks like a different city. And this isn't, like, because nobody wants, like rents are also super low in Austin. And there's, like, two sides of that. There's supply and demand. And one might be tempted to say, well, nobody wants to live in Austin, but that's just not the case. You know, you ask anybody in Houston,
do you want to live in Dallas, do you want to live in Austin?
I'd like to. Like, everyone wants to live in Austin. Austin's the cool place to live. It's like the LA of Texas. Like, people want to go there. So it's clearly not, like, a low demand thing. It's, they're doing something right. I think they've enacted good policies. Houston has done similar things. They have very, very notoriously soft zoning policies. So there's that, obviously. I think you would have to have a very strong state capacity if you wanted to, like, provide a universal layer of guaranteed homelessness, but I think it is possible. I think a really good example of this is Japan. Japan is a country of almost a billion people, right?
A good amount.
I don't know.
Off the top of my head, but yeah,
maybe like, okay, 100 million. Okay, not nearly as much as I thought, but...
a lot of people. We'll put it that way.
They have, in their entire country, about 2,000 homeless people. And this is, like, in Tokyo. Like, if there was a city in the size... If there was a city the size of Tokyo in the U.S., there would be, like, a bajillion homeless people. So clearly, like, Japan is doing something right. And I think a big thing is that they have a pretty generous welfare system there that kind of just doesn't accept homelessness as this thing. And I think a lot of it in Japan is also a cultural thing. Like this culture of there's a very, very strong stigma around homelessness and also like around hospitality. But I think a lot of it is like statewide decisions on the part of a government to support like very strong housing policies, because Tokyo is another place that has notoriously very low rents for a city of its size.
Well, I think you can look
at Tokyo also has very, very, you know, not great houses, but like these tiny, tiny little condos that people have.
Yeah, that's
I think
kind of...
that's fine. That's great. That beats living on the street. So that's the kind of things that I would want. I would want like not a great quality of housing, because obviously like cost is a worry, but like anything's better than people living on the streets. So if there's a way to do this with like it being entirely free market, I would like that. But so far I haven't seen a good case of this being done like entirely through market forces and market incentives. So just to go back to your question, yeah, I think you would have to have a pretty strong government program for this to work.
I guess the one thing, and I will kind of pivot from there, is, in the case of Japan, they have extreme, especially Tokyo, extreme density, which allows, is a supply thing. They have enormous supply.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, maybe it's not the best supply. You mentioned that, you know, they're not the best apartments, but it's supply nevertheless, which allows, you know, rents to go down like that. You know, there's a lot to consider, I guess, very briefly, because I know there's a bigger topic we want to get to. While we're on the topic of other nations, immigration never ceases to be a topic of interest. I know we have very many overlapping positions on this, but I guess the thing I wanted to probe you on a little bit was, as it relates to the illegal nature of crossings, you know, be it for someone who's either of ill intent or not. Because we definitely agree, you know, there needs to be reform in the system as it relates to making it easier to immigrate. But as it relates to people who do come illegally, if you do go about treating it as a criminal offense, being that it is a crossing that is not legal. So I'm curious to probe your thoughts on that, especially being from a border state. Kind of very briefly what you think.
I have to organize my thoughts for a second. Sorry. I feel like when we call it like this illegal, like it moralizes it a lot that they've done some big crime. And I just don't see illegal things as necessarily morally bad things, you know. You can imagine a situation like a mother stealing food for her starving kids. I don't see that as morally bad. And a lot of the times, this illegal immigration is a similar thing. It's these people in very, very desperate situations, so desperate that like I can't even imagine having to make some of these decisions. I know in the case of very famous case recently of Kill. I'm not sure exactly what his name is. I think it's Kilmar Abrego Garcia.
It's the Venezuelan gentleman.
El Salvadorian.
Oh, sorry. We're jumping between El Salvador and Venezuela so much right now in the news. Get the streams crossed. But yes.
He was coming to the United States because a gang back in El Salvador was threatening the life of him and his family. And he came here and he worked in the United States. He has a pretty good paying job. He's contributing to the economy. He's paying taxes. He's buying local goods. He has a family. He has a wife who's an American citizen. He has a kids here. And even though, yes, he came here illegally originally, I'm not comfortable saying he's any less American than you and me. And so it's sort of a case-by-case basis like that. If they're coming here to do terrible things, then obviously I'm not happy with that. If they're here to do crimes, if they're here to smuggle drugs, that's not great. But I don't think that's the vast majority of the people who are being deported right now. So I think you'd have to deal with that on a case-by-case basis, decide, is this person well integrated in the American society and the American economy? Are they contributing to our economy? And did they come here under a situation of distress? I think those are all considerations you have to make in these cases. And I think more often than not, I would like these people to stay here because it is a good thing for immigrants to be here, and it's very difficult for them to come here right now.
Yeah, and I think that's the crux of where we have a lot of our agreement. That, you know, I think we both agree it should be easier to come here. You know, I definitely hold the sentiment that it is a good thing to have immigrants in this country. I mean, I wouldn't be here right now if it weren't for the fact that my grandparents came here as recently as the 1960s. So, you know, I definitely have.
Neither of us are Native Americans, I don't think. I don't think most of the people listening are 100% Native Americans, so we're all immigrants.
And I think, you know, kind of where the thing I wanted to kind of zero in on is, you know, you bring up the point of, say, you know, a mother who steals bread. You know, we show compassion in those cases where we review the violation of the law. I'm curious to what extent do we provide, say, slaps on the wrist, because I mean, you know, you're still talking about, irrespective of the fact that, you know, potentially there's a moral good or even a moral ambiguity, you know, there is a law that's broken. I think that's, you know, the kind of the key core and principle thing here. To what extent do you exercise grace, and to what extent do you go about the upholding of the law? So I mean, you know, there it's a lot to kind of touch on, but unfortunately we cap ourselves to 30 minutes here, and you know, restrain the you know, free flow of intellectual debate. But I know, you know, there was the one thing that you wanted to get to, and I definitely want to make sure we had some time to speak about it. You wanted to speak about gender. You know, I would assume this is of a broad kind of heady, general, what do we think here?